Today I want to talk about on-the-spot dice spins. I mean decisions. So this poor college kid from Indiana, he solves the puzzle. All he has to do is read it. Mythological hero Achilles. He'll win $1 million. It'll open up doors. It'll change his future. And like that, it's gone. It's breathtaking, really. In a 30-minute episode, he has these three moments where his life could be changed. $1 million, a new car, $7,500. In life, there are moments of disproportionate impact. Moments when, for example, $1 million is at stake. Moments when the next words out of your mouth, the next decision you make, the next thing that you do will have a lasting impact in your life, in your home, in your career, in your community, for good or for bad. If you make a good decision, it could open up doors, it could create a future. In that moment, a good decision could heal, could help, could reconcile, could propel, could bring health. It could bring you to a new depth of wholeness. In that moment, a bad decision, though, could close doors. It could leave scars on your soul. It could ruin relationships. It could bring you to new levels of separation and pain and hurt and depression and misery. We experience this with words like shame and guilt and remorse and regret. In life, there are moments of disproportionate impact. If you could stop just for a moment and think over the last year or two of your life, I bet there are some moments that will pop to your mind immediately. Like you've had hundreds of conversations with your spouse, hundreds in the last couple of years, but there are one or two or three, there are precious few that actually change the way you relate to one another. There are precious few that affect the way you think and feel about one another, for good or for bad. You've had hundreds of interactions with coworkers and friends and neighbors and your kids, hundreds and maybe thousands. But there are precious few that actually change your life. You've spent dozens, hopefully hundreds of hours with God, but there are precious few that are going to alter the shape of your soul, the direction of your life. These few, these moments of disproportionate impact, these moments that in the next thing you do, the next thing you say, that the next decision you make is going to shape the rest of your life, they can lead us to a new depth of life with God. But in Hebrew, the word is shalom. It's wholeness, it's completion. It's, the Apostle Paul calls it, the life that is truly life. Or these moments can lead us to a new depth of separation and meaningless and despair. Today, we're going to look at one such moment of disproportionate impact. And it's a story that has been told for centuries and centuries, ages now. It was popular among ancient rabbis that this was the story that you would go to when you wanted to talk about these moments in your life where you have to make a decision. This is the story that they would bring up. It's a story that, following this very ancient tradition, the author of Hebrews actually pulls out as a warning passage for us to consider. Hebrews chapter 12. If there's one story that you need to know about how to capture that moment when it comes your way, this is the story you need to hear. It's Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, starting in verse 19. And the story, Lord willing, will wake us up so that we do not miss the moment when it comes to us. It begins like this, starting in verse 19. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramean from Padan Aram, and the sister of Laban the Aramean. Lots of interesting stuff here. We're not going to talk about it. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. It's fantastic. The babies jostled within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So when Jenny and I first started a family, we found out that when Jenny was rotund with child, and I mean that in the best way possible. When we go to church, there's something about church that our daughter woke up and decided it was her time for her exercise routines. So we would sit down in church and completely ignore the pastor and watch Jenny's belly. And you would see like this knee and this hand and this fist little like move across, and it was mesmerizing, you know, this stomach. And that is jostling. And that is not what's happening in this passage. The word in Hebrew for jostling is this. It literally means to crush, destroy, or oppress. It's warfare language. Another translation of this exact same verse puts it this way in the New English Translation. But the children struggled. They jostled inside her. And she said, if it's going to be like this, I'm not so sure I want to be pregnant. Yes, that is what's going on. It's a battle royale within her belly. So she does what any normal person would do. I prayed for this. Now I need to ask God, what is going on? So she went to inquire of the Lord. And verse 23 says, the Lord said to her, here's his explanation. You notice he writes her a little poem. Two nations are in your womb. Well, that explains something. Two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. Rebecca, here's the deal. Here's what's going on right now. What's happening in your womb is actually only going to get worse when they come out. You've got twins in there, two boys, a boy that you're going to name Jacob, and he's going to be the father of the Israelite people, and a boy named Esau, and he's going to be the father of the Edomites. And when they come out of the womb, that jostling that you see right now, for generations to come, these two brothers are going to go at it for generations to come. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was covered like a hairy garment. So I visit a lot of moms at the hospital, you know. I just imagine, you like, you show up there, and you're like, your baby is so cute. Wow. So they named him Harry. That's what Esau means in Hebrew. He was all hairy, so they said, hey, here's Harry. After this, his brother came out, and his hand was grasping Esau's heel. This is supposed to be funny. He's grabbing his heel, but what it looks like when he comes out is it looks like he's saying, hey, get back in here. He's trying to pull him back into the womb so that he can be the first one out. That being the firstborn was something special in that culture. So he's trying to supplant him. He's trying to usurp his position as the firstborn. So when he comes out, they named him usurper. Jacob. So this is the story of Harry and the usurper. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. Verse 27. Now the boys grew up, and Harry, he became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob, the usurper, was a quiet man, literally a perfect man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau. Daddy loved that boy. But Rebekah loved Jacob. So let's put this together, put this in context. We're in the Middle Bronze Age. Imagine, okay, in the Middle Bronze Age, nothing says, I'm a man. Like going out into the open country with nothing but like a spear and testosterone and extra manliness and facial hair and coming back with a large dead carcass. And that, my friends, is Esau. Also, though, in the Middle Bronze Age, nothing says I'm a wuss. Like staying at home with mama while your twin brother's out in the wilderness destroying animals. And that is Jacob. So Esau, he comes out of the womb and he's shaving. He likes to kill things with his hands. And his dad's like, that's my boy. Like Jacob, he's just a perfect little boy. He likes his mommy and loves to stay at home. She's like, why can't you be perfect like your brother? Which brings us to our story. The moment of disproportionate impact. The moment that would change their lives forever. Starts in verse 29. Once when Jacob was cooking up some stew. This is funny. In the Hebrew, cooking up some stew has double meaning. It's like concocting a plan. It's like stirring up trouble. So Jacob's just home cooking up some stew. Esau came in from the open country famished. And I want you to notice this. How does Esau come home? What state is he in when he meets this moment of disproportionate impact in his life? This moment that is going to shape his future for good, for bad. What's he like? He's weak. He's not thinking clearly. And may I suggest to you that these moments, more often than not, do not come to us when we're feeling strong and healthy and ready to take on the world. That these moments tend to come to us when we are exhausted, when we are sleepless, when our blood sugar levels are low, when we're tired, when we're in pain, when we're in conflict, when we're weak. So, Esau, you're not in good shape, friend. How are you going to handle this moment? Let's see. Ooh. Let me go back. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. That's why he is called Edom. Now, here we got to unpack this a little bit. A lot of this is buried in the Hebrew language, and I'm a little bit sorry for that, but this is so much fun. So let's dig into this for a second. So he comes in, Jacob's cooking up some stew, Esau comes in from the open country famished, and what does Esau say to Jacob? He says, very literally, now let me devour ha-adam, that red stuff, I am famished. Now, if you read this, this does not read like a normal person would speak. In fact, the ancient rabbis delighted to point out that they didn't like Edomites and they didn't like Esau. So they delighted to point out that in this moment, Esau is acting more like an animal than a man made in the image and likeness of God. He is utterly driven by desire. Have you ever seen a bunch of dogs eating as fast as they can? I'm not talking about little dogs. I'm talking about dogs, like a dog that Esau would have, a manly dog. Have you ever seen that? I've seen them like put their paws on, they're growling at each other, and they're eating as fast as they can. Like it's mesmerizing. It's kind of awesome and it's kind of disgusting at the same time. It's like, how can you actually swallow that and not choke? Well, there's a special word in Hebrew for that. That eating like a ravenous dog, like a something over its prey. It's a word that is reserved usually for animals, and that is the word that Esau uses for himself here. Literally, let me eat like a dog. Let me lap up, let me gulp down. And he doesn't even say stew or lentils, he says that red stuff. Here's the traditional dish, by the way, of what they think Jacob made. That red stuff. So what's Jacob say? Verse 31. First, sell me your birthright. Now, I want you to understand, this is an absolutely ridiculous thing. Like, it's like we're sitting down at lunch, and you're like, hey, can you pass me the salt? And I'm like, sure, just sell me your soul. That's all I want. Your soul, salt, deal? Like, this is just stupid. Like, someone wouldn't say this. In this ancient tribal nomadic culture, the birthright was everything. Like, Isaac was wealthy beyond belief. His father Abraham had given him servants and camels and cattle and precious metals and so much. He was extraordinarily wealthy. And as a firstborn, Esau had the inheritance, the birthright, of a double portion, that the vast majority of that was going to be his. But it wasn't just the money. It was beyond that. It was this honor. It was a mantle of leadership that the firstborn son got to function as a prophet, a priest, and a king for the whole family. And this family was a tribe. Do you understand? Hundreds of people were under his leadership. This is money. This is honor. This is power. But that's not all. Esau's birthright was special. If you remember the birthright through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, well, what is that birthright? That birthright is not just stuff, but it's something much bigger. It's the very promises of God have been tied to this. That God had promised that through a son of Abraham, that through a son of Isaac, that he would change the world, that he would bless the entire world, that he would give them God's own land, that they would form God's own people, that Esau has the birthright, the opportunity to live out the promises of God. He has an opportunity to be a vehicle of salvation, to bring God's blessing to the entire world. So here's the question, Esau. Here's what Jacob just asked you. Would you like to give up your identity, your future, your honor, and the very promises of God for a bowl of red stuff? What do you say, Esau? Look, I'm about to die. What good is the birthright to me? Really? Really? Did you just ask that? But Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. Do you realize how horrible this is? It's not even good stew. It's lentil stew. Have you eaten lentil stew? The best lentil stew in the world is mediocre. You just sold your birthright for lentil stew. And then, classic text here, like an animal. And he ate, and he drank, and he stood up, and he walked away. And so Esau despised his birthright, despised the wealth, despised the inheritance, despised the very promises of God. That's the moment of disproportionate impact. That moment would then open up doors for Jacob. He would experience blessing and health and favor in new ways. He would experience a depth of life with God unlike anything he had known prior to this. And that decision in that moment would scar Esau's soul for life. It would ruin relationships. It would separate him from God and from his family. It would bring him to deep regret. The text later will say that he weeps, he begs, he pleads. The language is like blubbering when you can't stop the flow of snot and tears. That's what he does, begging to get it back. But it's too late. The moment's passed. I want you to hear this. One moment changed everything. Jacob is the one who gets to change the world. Jacob gets listed among the greats in Hebrews chapter 11. He's in the hall of faith. Jacob gets to be eternally honored as the father of God's people. It is through Jacob that the Messiah would come. And Esau got a bowl of lentil stew. We are all faced with these moments. Moments that make or break our relationships. Moments that shape our future and our soul. And under good circumstances, I don't think that anyone would sell their birthright for a bowl of stew. In fact, we could go on from there. Under good circumstances, no one would choose to keep the good news of Jesus Christ to themselves. No one would. Under good circumstances, no one who had extra money would choose to not be generous and not help someone who is in need. Under good circumstances, no one would choose to mindlessly entertain themselves when they could be engaging deeply with the very God of the universe. And under good circumstances, no one would speak hatefully to their spouse, the very person they vowed to love and honor. Under good circumstances, no sane person would choose their work over their family. Under good circumstances, no husband would decide to give up his marriage, his reputation, his church, his relationship with God and others for a few moments of illicit pleasure. But here's the deal. We don't always live in good circumstances, do we? And this stuff, to use Esau's word, happens all the time. Men and women, children of God, people for whom God has promised the greatest inheritance you can imagine. People for whom they've received the very name of God. People for whom Jesus Christ died to give them life. Trade that in all the time for cheap pleasures, for trinkets, for a bit of greed, for a bit of self-indulgence, just because it feels sneaky, for a bowl of stew. You know what else happens in that same moment? Maybe not as often, but also happens is that there are men and women, children of God, people of the inheritance, people whose birthright is in Jesus Christ, who have treasures stored up in heaven. There are people who actually choose loss in this world that they might have gain in the next. There are people who choose to be generous rather than be rich in this world. There are people who choose to suffer rather than let go of any of the promises of God. There are people who choose to view other people not as an object of pleasure, but as a person made in the image and likeness of God. I want you to hear that. The same moment, the same circumstances, the same pressures of life, the same pain, the same conflict, the same exhaustion, the same tiredness, the same God. And yet very, very different outcomes. We cannot control the moments that come our way, but we can prepare for them. Like the rabbis of old point out, Esau was not ready for his moment. But we can be. For the last 3,500 years, followers of God have practiced a discipline that is designed to prepare us for these moments of disproportionate impact. Since the day that God gave us his law, and you know what his law is? It's the best, deepest, fullest way to live life with God. It's not some way to earn God's pleasure. But it's for saved people, for God's people, people who have already been saved. He gives them his law so you can say, this is what it looks like to do life with me, life the way you're designed to be. And the day he gives the law, he gives them this. Deuteronomy chapter 4, only be careful and watch yourselves closely so that you do not forget the things that your eyes have seen or let them slip away from your heart as long as you live. He repeats this exact same thing just six verses later in verse 15. Only be careful that when you receive this law, you know what you're supposed to do with it? You're supposed to watch yourselves carefully. David will say it this way in Psalms 26, test me, O Lord, and try me. Examine my heart, my mind. Psalm 139, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Solomon will advise his sons this, above all else, guard. Guard, keep watch over. Like protect, build a fence around, nurture, protect, look at your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. The Apostle Paul puts it this way, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. It is the practice of self-examination. And it's a discipline that seems to be completely missing from Esau's life. Esau makes his decisions with all the forethought of a dog chasing a squirrel. You, my friends, men and women made in the image of God. Do you know your inheritance? Do you know what God is calling you to? Man, it's for something greater than a bowl of stew. It's not to settle for something small. And so, God gives us an opportunity to realize in what ways are we living according to his law, to that depth, to that fullness, to that richness that we're called to live? In what ways are we not? Are we off? So before we go into this word, let me unpack a couple of things. First of all, if you've ever done anything spiritually under the category of self-examination, you know that this category can be painful. So let me say this, at least in our church, when we say self-examination, here's what it is not. It is not a neurotic, shame-inducing inventory of all the ways that I'm a bad, bad person. It is not that. The promise of the gospel is that written over every sin is paid in full. Do you understand? This is not a moment to wallow in shame. But self-examination is using the word of God to expose sin in our lives that we may more fully believe and love and live life with God. It's the fullness to what he's calling us to. James, the brother of Jesus, will describe it this way. He says, the scriptures, they're like a mirror that we use to look at ourselves with. And when you look in the scriptures, they're going to show you who you really are. It's going to uncover all those blemishes. Have you ever looked in one of those like makeup mirrors? Not that I would ever do that. But, you know, they have that light and then they expand everything. You can see every blemish. You can see every pore. That's what the scriptures are for us. They show us reality. Self-examination is not a spiritual scorecard. If you get a perfect score, then God will love you. That's just not true. The gospel is not that if you get a perfect score, God will love you. The gospel is that while you were a sinner, while you did nothing, while you were an enemy, while you hated God, while you were dead in your trespasses and sins, God loved you. He came after you. And so now we respond to his love. And so self-examination is regularly looking at our lives to see if I'm actually responding to that love or not. Or if I'm living for the wrong things, if I'm living in a way that shrinks my soul, a way that turns away from God. It is taking a sober look at our weaknesses, our strengths, our temptations, our passions, our motives, our hopes, and our loves. It is seeing myself truly for what I am and who I am. So let's get practical here. If you sit down and say, okay, I want to practice self-examination, this will be awesome. I'm sure all of you are thinking that right now. Let me say, there's no official method or structure or rules that you're supposed to follow here. If you go back through history, you find, I mean, obviously through the scriptures, they do this all the time. A lot of the Psalms, that's what it is. The Psalm is someone writing down how God has gone through their heart point by point. You go to some guy like Jonathan Edwards, and he would break out his list of 75 questions. And he would recommend that every night before you go to bed, you go through all 75 questions and examine your life. There's 75 questions are based upon the Ten Commandments, and then that tells you whether your life is in line with the fullness of God. For most of us, that's a bit daunting. So here's what I'm gonna suggest. Perhaps maybe this is something that you want to work in this weekly routine. I would suggest that it's not something that's beyond what you're currently doing, that you make this part of the times that you meet with God, that when you read the scriptures, you use it to reflect your life and say, does my life look like that? You're going to find that self-examination is, while some disciplines like reading scripture and prayer, that should just be like breathing. That should be part of your life. You want that to be part of the fabric of your life. Self-examination is more on an on-demand basis. If you are following the scriptures, if you're connecting with God, if you're taking risk of faith, you won't find much need for this. I mean, it's still helpful, but you won't find much need for this. It's the times when you're failing. It's the times when you're filled with regret. It's the times when you feel like something's not clicking here. Those are the times that you need to stop and spend some time with God reflecting. Let me give you a few guidelines here. First, make sure that you invite God to guide you. Jeremiah chapter 17, the heart is wicked. The heart is a labyrinth. Like if you try and sort out your own heart by yourself with just your own psychoanalysis, well, we just have the amazing ability to deceive ourselves. You want to invite God. Search me, O God. Try me. Test me. You want to invite God to lead you. The next thing I would say, just on a real practical level, is use something to write with. I don't know. I personally, I'm just old-fashioned. I like a pen and paper. I actually like things called journals. But I know that a lot of you don't really know what those are. And you only think in typing terms, that's fine. Here's the deal. If I ask you to sit and focus on a line of thought without anything to write down, anywhere to write, it's very, very difficult to keep a line of thought. But if I hand you a pen or if I give you a notebook to write in, you can sustain that for a long time. You can go to depths and discover things that you could never find without that. So those are my only two guidelines for that. And then I'm going to say there's three questions that I want you to ask. So this week, three questions that you need to know in order to make the most of moments of disproportionate impact. Number one is this: when am I weak and most liable to make bad decisions? When am I most likely to make an Esau-like decision, a decision that I'm going to regret, a decision that will not reflect what God has called me to do and be? So let's get practical here for a minute. Some of you are night people and you just thrive at night. But others of us, after about 10 o'clock at night, we just become sinful. We just do. It's just bad things happen after it gets dark. It's not good. For me, if I haven't had my coffee, I hate everybody. It's not prejudice. I hate everyone equally. For some of you, it's lack of sleep, stress, pain when I'm around that person. For some of you, it's alcohol, and you need to watch yourselves. For some of you, it's when you eat carbs. For some of you, it's when you don't eat carbs. For me, probably the one that I have to know about very carefully, and I have to guard, I have to monitor, is when I never have any time alone. So when we have family come in town, and I am with people engaging 24 hours a day. After about day two, my parents just must think I'm an awful person because every time they come around, I am an awful person. Like, I never get a moment. So I've had to learn that even no matter what's going on, I don't care if the President of the United States is visiting me. Sorry, I'm going to have to excuse myself for an hour. It's the only way I cannot lose my sanctification. That's for me, but what is it for you? Do you know your weak spots? Because let me tell you, there is a tempter who does know your weak spots. You better know it. Question number two: what's in my bowl? And that's what these bowls are about. I want you all to take this bowl and think about this. Hold that up. What is in my bowl? What is my red stuff? So I want you to take this week and think, what is it for me? And let's make this practical. What are the fleeting desires that in a moment of weakness, I might be tempted to walk away from what I believe about God for that? What are the stupid things in my life that in a moment of weakness, I might actually despise the grace and goodness and inheritance and death of Jesus Christ? I might despise those things. What's my stew? Is it lust? Is it possessions? Is it a career? Is it a relationship? Is it a title? Is it a degree? Is it fame? Is it friendships? What tempts you to make terrible soul-shaping decisions? Now, I want you to know, if we just stopped right here, if you just know these two things about yourself and you got it down, if you know when you're weak and you know what your red stuff is, then you can do something about this. You can master most of those moments. If you know when you're weak and you know what tempts you, you can avoid, you can plan ahead, and you can make yourself accountable. Let me tell you a secret that took a lot of beating for me to learn. Being godly is less about becoming strong enough to overcome your temptations and more about knowing how weak you really are so that you can avoid them. Being godly is less about becoming strong enough to overcome all your temptations and more about knowing how weak you really are so you avoid them. Do you know why I don't struggle with looking at sexually explicit material on my personal computer? It's because I'm a spiritual giant. And my wife gets a log of every web page I look at. And that, my friends, is why I'm safe. Because I know that I am not good. I know that in a moment of weakness, I will make a decision that betrays what I believe about God, that betrays my marriage, that betrays you, that is unbecoming of a man or woman made in the image of God. So I avoid, I plan ahead, and I make myself accountable. And last, how is this going to play out? So if I make a decision that is lustful or self-indulgent or greedy or self-righteous, how will this affect my life, my family, my church, my work, my community, my relationship with God in the long run? Like, this is what the Puritan genius Jonathan Owens calls fixing in your mind the sinfulness of sin and the goodness of the gospel. But since most of you don't read Puritans, let's talk about Henry Cloud. He's a Christian author, psychologist. And he says this is playing the movie. Same thing. John Owens, Henry Cloud. He says, okay, so there's this old man sitting on a park bench, just doing nothing, watching people go by. A young man comes up to him, and the man clearly has a watch on, so the young man comes up to him and says, excuse me, sir, could I get the time? And the old man stops and looks him up and down and pauses for a minute, and he says, no! And the young man's like, I can see you have a watch. Why won't you give me the time? And he says, well, if I tell you the time, then you're going to introduce yourself. And if you introduce yourself, we might become friends. I come here every week, and we might start hanging out. And if we start hanging out, you might find out that I have a beautiful daughter. And if you meet my beautiful daughter, you will probably fall in love because she's beautiful. And if you fall in love, next thing I know, you're going to ask my daughter for her hand in marriage. And I will be darned if my daughter marries a man who doesn't own a watch. See what he did? He played the movie. He took that one little scene and said, how's this going to play out? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? If I make this decision at this moment, if I choose a bowl of stew, if I choose a little bit of lust, a little bit of greed, a little morsel of self-righteousness or self-indulgence, if I choose this small decision, this seemingly small decision at this moment, how's this going to play out over my life? What kind of person is it going to make me to be? What's that going to do for my family, for my church, for my job, for my career? What's that going to say about my God and His goodness? Play the movie. It will change the decisions you make. If you know where you're weak and you know what your red stuff is and you play the movie. In life, there are moments of disproportionate impact, moments when the next words out of your mouth, when the next decision you make, when the next thing you do is going to have a lasting impact on your life. It's going to change your life. It's going to change your home. It's going to change your family. It's going to change your career. It's going to change your relationship with God. It's going to change our community. Now, you can't control when these moments come, but you can be ready for them. Let's pray.